The following program has been furnished and paid for by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSCB and KGBC are not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. We're glad you could join us once again. And before we get started, I want to remind you that just because we discuss certain tax strategies or tax data or investment options, etc., throughout the course of today's show or any show that we undertake, please don't run out and make a financial decision without checking with your existing advisors, not only financial, but legal, real estate advisors, retirement plan or financial planning advisors. Make sure that what you thought you heard applies to your unique facts and circumstances and is something that you should possibly consider to help you achieve your goals and objectives. If you don't have advisors, you're more than welcome to go to our website on the forms page. That's at baplanner.com, baplanner.com. And if you'll go to the forms page, you'll see the link there at the top right. You can then complete at least step one of Form 1 there on that page, and that'll give us enough information to help or to explain how we may or may not be able to help you. And if you're wanting help with accessing your retirement funds, if you would be kind enough to fill out the form that's step 2, the retirement profile, that would be very helpful as well. You know, it's the current multifamily market, and as those of you that listen ongoing understand, that's the area we tend to focus on with our real estate investor clients. It's got a lot of benefits for those that are interested in avoiding or staying away from the single family market. And, you know, it's not necessarily, single family is not necessarily a bad thing. We have clients that only focus on single family. We've got a lot of clients that focus on multifamily. And then we've got people that are bifurcating that decision. They've got some of both. And, you know, there's nothing like having owned more than a few units on both sides of that fence, as I have, that will help sharpen your focus in terms of what makes the most sense for you. And I, as of late, I've been talking more and more about small apartment complexes. I think at the moment, and maybe for the foreseeable future, those are where the lower hanging fruit, i.e. profits, will be found. And, you know, for those of us that have invested in the large syndication market with large projects, and by large, I would say anything over 200 units up to, I don't know, we've got some clients that are in some 1,000-unit portfolio transactions, and the whole conundrum of putting those deals together, if you're a lead partner or a sponsor, is such that I struggle to say that there's not too much of a focus on the fees that can be generated by those projects rather than the value that can be returned to the passive investor. It's hard not to think that when you look at some of the transactions that have been undertaken in the recent past. And, you know, it's already the case now, and I knew this would happen, and I just saw a transaction this week that reminded me, oh, yeah, we got to watch out for that now. You know, with the current debt structure being so critical of any deal that you're going to invest in, and the fact that we've still got a lot of bridge debt still floating around in the market, because roughly 3 years ago that started the trend again of almost every deal that we saw offered was utilizing bridge debt. And bridge is a form of debt that's meant to be temporary. It's meant to allow a developer or a sponsor or syndicator the ability to purchase a value add. Typically, it's a value add scenario. I guess you could be building a project that might be a bridge that might tend to be more of a mezzanine type loan, a little bit longer. But bottom line is the bridge debt was not and is not thought to be a permanent loan. Yeah, with at least a 10-year term, and it's meant to get in, you know, an acquisition, do your upgrade or your enhancements, execute on getting your rent rental rates up since you've improved the property, and voila, after 2 to 3 years, exit out of the bridge debt into a permanent loan scenario. And almost every transaction we reviewed starting about 3 years ago, it seemed like, I mean, there were some exceptions, but for the most part, it was bridge debt. Well, one of the other aspects of bridge debt that is unfortunately, when you run into the buzzsaw with interest rates that we did a couple years ago now, bridge debt really is difficult to work with because the rates are going to go up as the Fed Reserve raises their rates. And as you may recall, there were 11 such rate increases undertaken by the Fed, starting at about the 2.5 year ago mark. And that just totally, that length of interest rate increases really outstripped most of the rate caps that syndicators had purchased to try to protect against being caught with those rate changes. And an awful lot of deals have either gone under or the lenders are, as we say, kicking the can down the road with respect to forcing a foreclosure or other property give back, maybe a deed in lieu of foreclosure would be on the residential side. It'd be in a similar context. But now what we're seeing, and this is, you know, again, that don't think that syndicators or lead partners are not creative. Some of the most creative people in the world, and that comes from being on thin ice when it comes to your partner group, your lender, etc. And so what we're seeing again, I'm just going to warn you, you're going to see more of this, is what I call a retread deal, where the current partnership has the property, it's got the bad debt structure, it's maybe not executed 100% on their business plan, so the lender that they're with currently is not willing to refinance. They want the property to either, or the partnership to either pay the loan back, you know, through a refinance, obviously, or give the property back. So now we're seeing, and this didn't just start, we've seen a few of these along the way, where syndicators are syndicating a new version of the same property. So they're putting a new partnership together that will purchase or acquire the property from the existing partnership. And I don't like those transactions. I advise clients that do bring those to me for review to avoid doing that, especially when you've got a same syndicator that's running Rev 2 as was running Rev 1. You know, who's their loyalty going to be to? The folks that they're trying to exit, and which one of those folks is them themselves. They are a member of that partnership, just as they're likely going to be a member in the new one. To whom do their loyalties lie? Are they going to be trying to goose the gain that's in the first one, which again gives them more profit on the first deal? Or are they going to do something for the second deal that would enhance or otherwise make the returns more attractive, or at least set the tilt the deck towards the second group? And I would argue that's very rare that that's the case on the ones that I've observed in the past. And I would tell you, if you've got that choice as a investor, you know, if you're coming out of the existing partnership, you still need to understand what the projected return will be. But I would tell you, more importantly, if you're not in the first Rev and you're looking to join the second Rev that's buying the property from the first Rev, I would be hyper careful about how the deal's being structured, and I would want to know everything. I'd want to know as much about that first Rev of the transaction as any of the partners in that transaction are being provided pro forma financial information about what their gain's going to be, et cetera, because I don't like it. It smells bad, and I would tell you to try to invest in transactions that are freely available in the market. There's nobody stepping on the scale, so to speak, to tilt the scale one way or the other in terms of the math on those types of transactions. But in any event, there was an article that I was going to mention that caught my eye. This is intriguing. This article was on Globe Street, one of the significant white paper research for market research firms that provide all sorts of updates in different segments of the market, et cetera. Pretty good source for current information. They're talking about the Fresno, talking about a couple markets here, but one that leads off, that's in the headline, is multifamily demand in Fresno surges by 70%. That's pretty amazing. Said overall, Fresno, California's multifamily sector features solid fundamentals as limited new supply enters the market, but there's certainly nothing short of demand as net absorption surged by 70% year over year in the second quarter to 741 units. So that right there is one of the weaknesses of data. You know, we can make, we can make numbers or statistics, et cetera. Seemingly, we can bend it to fit the narrative we're seeking. And if you're talking about a market with, and it is a relative big change. I mean, the historical average was about 350 units. So I guess the fact that it's doubled is significant, but it's still a relatively insignificant market in the overall scheme of things. But anyway, we'll go with the concept here. So a 70% year-over-year increase second quarter to 2025. A market report by Colliers, big real estate firm, finds that's well above the historical average of 354 units. Vacancy came in 43 basis points lower at 4.5%, below the historical average of 4.9. So you're talking about less than a 1% change in vacancy. So not huge, but in today's markets, not bad. And of course, Fresno is not one of the markets that we track. In fact, I don't think at the moment we track any market in California. But, you know, I can tell you they're not one of the consequential markets across the U.S. But let's see. Yeah, so vacancy was down a little. New supply is up. So those are the two factors there. So moving on, while those are two good signs, Colliers pointed out that rent growth, although positive, did slow down with just a 1.78% gain to 1,458. That's not a bad number for California. Heck, that's not a bad number for Houston, Texas, or Dallas, Texas. The CRE, the commercial real estate firm, CRE, noted that's down significantly from the highs in 2021, the monthly rental average, 1,458. According to Colliers, the slow rent growth is partially limiting building along with high cost. Multifamily units under construction in Dallas tumbled by 84% in the second quarter to just 96. That's in a big city. Construction is almost nothing, 96 units. Also, deliveries dropped from 785 units to 523. These are puny numbers for a market the size of Dallas. Another thing that slowed down was sales, which hit a volume of just 58 million, down from the historical average of 134.7 million. Most of the deals were smaller in volume, with just four transactions exceeding $5 million. So if you were selling a property for $5 million, that would, just on a 50-unit property at $100,000, which that's low for that market, I'd say $150 per door would be more likely. So you're talking about, 30, 35 unit on average complex. So again, these are, if for something the size of Dallas, those are almost that's almost no news. You know, that doesn't register much at all. Let's see, the lack of sales activity is mostly due to fears that valuations have yet to bottom out, which I know we're seeing references to that concept in several other sources we track. Investor activity in the region is not expected to increase rapidly in 2025, as additional increases in cap rates are expected to rise throughout the remainder of the year, which means the price points will go down a bit. Private investors made up most of the acquisitions, 85%. The largest sale involved lofts at Stadium Square, trading hands for $30 million. So again, that's a little bit bigger of a transaction, but if that's a newish property, that's still not much more than, what, 150 or so, 150,000 a door or so. Going forward, Colliers noted that the return of the 100% bonus depreciation a tax incentive for qualifying properties. That was one of the 2017 Trump Tax Cuts and Jobs Act provisions that really stimulated the syndication world, well, the real estate world, particularly multifamily. In any event, that could help to stimulate more selling and buying again. Now that the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, that would be your OBBBA, makes the 100% level permanent. So we were in the middle of the five-year phase-out. I forget, I think this year it was going to be the 40% level until the One Big Beautiful Bill Act passed. So now it's going to go back up to 100%. So it'll be interesting to see just how much of an impact. It will definitely have an impact on the market. Why? Because there's a lot of things that get more fully baked planning-wise when you've got the tax rules that are supporting that activity. So, you know, there's people have been sitting on the sideline because they didn't like the declining tax incentives to invest, and now it looks like they're coming back. It'll be interesting to see just how fast it causes the syndication world to heat back up. Well, let's do this. We went past our first scheduled break. Let's go ahead and take a break now, and we'll circle back here momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough to take control and make the
okay, welcome back with more of this week's Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And we were just discussing the current some of the current trends in the multifamily market. Looks like there's some submarkets that are starting to heat up again. Pretty good occupancy and absorption. And so I thought that now would be a good time to revisit some of the market reports that we subscribe to, so we can see what is the averages in some of the markets we track, and primarily the Texas markets, but we've got some outliers thrown in, Nashville and Phoenix. Let's see, is it Phoenix, Tucson? I believe it's a combination of, Phoenix and Tucson. And also got DFW. And let me just get a few of these pulled up, and then we'll look at some of the numbers. I'll tell you, the one that I'm curious are concessions. I want to see what the growth looks like on those, because you can rest assured they're being used front and center to attract new tenants. Let's look at Houston first, since that's the city we're broadcasting from. It's not the city that we sit in. I'm actually sitting in my home overseas. Many of you know that I live in Bangkok, Thailand, most of the time. The most fascinating city in the world, and one that with proper planning you might consider for retirement. It is absolutely spectacular, but it is not for the uninitiated when it comes to all things living abroad. And I don't mean traveling abroad, but I mean getting to the point where you're wanting to stay permanently and you need visas and assorted other things, you know, leases on an apartment, all of which are, when compared to America, much more attainable and much more appealing cost wise and quality of life wise. I mean, there's no question you can live here compared to most Texas cities, at least, for probably 35 to 40% of what you would spend in a Houston or Dallas, probably a little bit less than than Austin, although right now Austin's become a little bit lower cost. But, you know, it's not just the lower cost. You can enhance your lifestyle at the same time. You can live a little bit large on even a lower cost. It's pretty amazing. But in any event, I like the Houston market because it's a very robust multifamily, as is Dallas. I mean, let's face it, the number of units that they're pumping through those cities is remarkable. Although I'm going to tell you, of all U.S. cities that I've spent the most time in within the recent past, San Antonio, which is where I own property, it's amazing how many new Class A apartment buildings came on the scene starting a couple years ago. It's just hard to describe. You'd have to drive through the downtown and near downtown area. That's the first hot zone, and then you could go out further to Loop 1604 or further out, and it's just amazing how many units have come into the market. And of course, the absorption, I believe we'll see. I haven't looked at the current issue of these resources we subscribe to, but in Houston, let's see here, the occupancy is currently, now this is average, and what have I cautioned about the use of that term every time we mention average? Average is for marketing, and none of us are average. We're all actual if you're an investor, but you got to have something to shoot at, and averages are what we use in the real estate business for the most part. And my favorite average is price per foot. If you're comparing a property, not necessarily a, well, it could apply to multifamily. If you're looking at the rent per square foot, the way you delineate real estate is price per square foot. And as an example, you're buying a home. Well, when you look at, and now most of the MLS systems around the country actually show the price per foot calculations in the listing. That wasn't always the case. I know back when I started focusing on real estate 20 plus years ago, I learned that I had to manually in my head on the fly, so to speak, be able to calculate price per foot, because it's part of every negotiation. It's part of everything we do when we're looking at multiple properties. And I know there used to be a gentleman, he was on the Forbes 400 list. He lived there in Houston, was one of the most successful commercial strip center operators ever. Jerry Moore, I believe, was his name. And he had one other thing he was known for. He had quite a classic car collection. It was right there on Loop 610 North, somewhere between the Shepherd and, I forget, maybe Yale was the other street. It's not there anymore. Something's there in that spot. I forget what it is. But in any event, I heard him speak once at the Northwest Houston Chamber of Commerce, and that was rare because he wasn't the kind to indulge in those types of he didn't like talking. Let me just say it that way. But there was a attorney around back then, Racehorse Haynes. I'm sure many of my listeners have remember that name, criminal defense lawyer of some national status. And he convinced him to come speak. Racehorse Haynes was active in that local Northwest Houston branch of the Chamber of Commerce. But anyway, he said two things that day that I'll never forget, and that's been, I was a young, less than 30-year-old CPA, and I'm a old 65-year-old CPA now, so it's been quite a while. And he said two things that I always will remember. He said when somebody, there was some prepared questions, excuse me, get a sip of some liquid there, coffee. One was, what did he attribute his success to? And he said, well, I can tell you, I never considered myself to be that smart, but I was a hard worker. And I used to get up every morning. He said, I would be working by 5 a.m. because I figured that you give me a 2 or 3 hour head start on everybody else in my industry, and I could, you know, hold close to the top performers. And he said, I just figured that would put me ahead of most and probably equal with the top. And the other thing he said was, you know, I wasn't good at math early on, but I realized right away I had to get good at what I just mentioned a minute ago, calculating the average price per square foot, because he said that's just a vital statistic. And I've told many of my clients, as I bring on new clients from time to time, I said, look, if you're new to real estate, you must learn how to calculate in your head. Doesn't have to be to the penny, but you need to know, are we dealing with a 200 square foot property, or is this a 400 square foot property? Because there's differences that will show up or should show up in that specific property. The finishes, the location, it's a way of delineating that piece of real estate versus another piece of real estate. And very important. But in any event, when I look at these stats on these reports that we get, I'm always looking at averages. And, you know, I don't see, let me think, I don't think they've got, unless they've added it lately and I just missed it. They do tell you the size of the you know, the average size of the units that they're surveying here. And so, and then they tell you the average rent. So you can very quickly, if you're just talking about the rental average, this doesn't have anything to do with sales. But in any event, so when we look at Houston, the average occupancy right now is 89%. So that's up a couple percent or so since I looked at this last. It's been a couple months when I discussed it on the air. And the price is down. It's $1,274 per unit. The rental rate is $1.42. So there's a price per foot, I suppose. Let's see, is that by the foot though? Well, I don't, $1.42. Yeah, it must be. And then the size is on here. So Houston's average is 895. So yeah, that would be the $1.42 would be the price per square foot, the rental rate per square foot. Units absorbed. This is like one of the most critical measures right now with all the oversupply that we had 6 months, 8 months, 9 months ago. 22,004 units have been absorbed in the last 12 months. It's a pretty healthy number given where we were. I mean, I can't remember. I'd have to go back and look if we ever were ever at negative absorption back then. But I'll tell you what, we were down pretty low. The operating supply of units is 779,980. That's across 3,295 apartment communities in the Houston area. So that's a lot of apartments. Units under construction, 41 communities. There's almost 10,000 units currently under construction. Units proposed for construction, and this is where it happens. Here we go again. Now that some absorption is occurring or has occurred in the last 12 months, now we've got 38,000 units proposed for construction. Now, that doesn't mean permitted and actually, you know, shovel ready, nothing like that, but it probably means they're further along than you might think. Maybe they have been, or maybe permits have been filed. I don't know. I'd have to look at how this group defines some of these metrics. The hottest submarkets, you know, there's some surprises on here for me. If you just ask me, I don't think I would have put Baytown at number two out of the top five. Richmond-Rosenberg, yeah, maybe. Number one, by the way, Highway 288 South in Pearland is number three. And let's see, number four is Bear Creek, Copperfield, Fairfield. That's a big radius. And then number six, this has gone down since I remember a few reports ago. The Conroe, North Montgomery County area is actually a negative 1%, almost 1%. Annualized growth, but percent of market absorption, Richmond Rosenberg's in the first slot, Highway 288 South, Pearland, etc. is in the third, and Conroe, North Montgomery in the fifth. Those are all 2.5% percent of the market absorption. Concessions, and again, this is, I would say, expected. The Baytown is number two again on this list. Baytown's number one, I'm sorry, 9.4%. Richmond Rosenberg 7.5. Those would be the two highest. 288 Pearland 6.9%. So when you think about it, roughly rent on an annual lease, 12-month lease, it's roughly 8% for each month, a little bit over that. So, you know, the landlords in Houston are giving away roughly a month in these higher concession ranges. Let's see. Let's compare to Dallas, Fort Worth. The occupancy in Dallas, Fort Worth is almost 89%. It's not far off from Houston. The price is higher. The annual rental or the monthly rental rate there at $1,448. The growth rate is down 3% over the past 12 months. Let's see here. 20,000 absorption, 28,000 units absorbed. So it's not quite as low as Houston's, but they're both healthy compared to where we've been. Let's see. Total of 916,000 units is the operating supply. That's across 3,787 communities. So Dallas is a bigger, and that's, you know, Dallas-Fort Worth, so it's a bigger, I assume the way they're measuring that, it's bigger than Houston. Maybe not, because Houston's got Baytown and these other outlying areas in them. Let's look at, let's see here. I was wanting to see, let me check, see if I can find the concession rates. I'm curious what that looks like in Dallas, Fort Worth. Here we are. Not quite as high as Houston. Well, there's one that's 8.2%. That would be Northwest Fort Worth, Saginaw submarket. The highest is Denton at 9.7. And let's see here. Is there anything else that was up over 7? Let's see, it looks like there's one other one that's over 7. Grapevine, that makes sense. So, you know, I know most of my clients, it seems like these days, are looking at either Houston or Dallas. There's some San Antonio, but San Antonio is back to where it's more expensive to invest there than seems like in Houston. I mean, it vacillates, but with their current huge influx of new units, it got down to where it was about the same as Houston. Let me take a quick peek at San Antonio now, and let's see what their numbers look like. I guess I closed that one. Let me pull it back up here real quick. Okay, so San Antonio, occupancy is lower. That's no surprise, 86.7%. The average monthly rate, less than Houston and Dallas. $1,163 rental rates, $1.33 a square foot. Let's see what else is notable. The absorption is only 8,950 units. And again, I mentioned that earlier, that they're working through a considerable influx of new units. They've got a total operating supply across 1,227 communities of 249,000. So it's a much smaller apartment market, even with the influx. They've got 6,600 units under construction. That was as many as 25,000 2 years ago. They've got 16,000 proposed for construction. And then they've got 12,300 recently open. So I would suggest their absorption is going to continue to be a drag on their being able to sustain rental rates and growth in rental rates, et cetera. Let's see. Oh, concessions. That's the one thing I wanted to check. Yeah, see, they've got their hot market. One of their hottest submarkets is the UTSA Bandera Road, Vance Jackson area. And they're over 10% concession, 10.6%. And downtown, Southtown, where we're at, 8.9%. So that's a full month on 12 that they're giving away in terms of the concessions. Okay, well, let's pivot and look at I wanted to just look at some headlines. I had a Globe Street list of the current week's articles. You know, they're talking about self-storage has the demand has surged in recent months. I was looking at, I don't have that article handy. I had a Houston article that was mentioning the number of, you know, a certain number of people out of every 10. And I want to say it was like one or two out of 10 had a self-storage unit in Houston. That sounds like a lot, but I guess, you know, when you think about the apartment market being as big as it is in Houston, that makes sense. Let's take a look. Here's an article. The strong apartment supply. Where is... supposed to last through the end of the year. Well, I don't see. I don't think that article is on. It's not within this particular link, so I'm going to have to circle back to that later on. But you know, the proposed construction on these cities we just looked at was significant enough to where I can understand why there's going to be the strength of the current market will likely not go past the end of the year unless there's, I mean, you've got other things that are going to be weighing down on the market, such as inflation, perhaps some interest rate increases. It's hard to say, but the multifamily market is so sensitive with respect to the debt structures right now that any sort of inflation bump or interest rate bump is going to be ill-timed if you're in the multifamily business. Let's see here. I wanted to check one other article if I can find it here real quick. This I think is notable, maybe not for most of our audience, but Lead Partners, I know, are seeing this because I've talked to some, where community banks are starting to fill the void that larger lenders have made as they've left the commercial real estate market. And, you know, the larger banks don't like, they're not as, they're really very risk averse when it comes to economic uncertainty, rate volatility, regulatory changes, et cetera, and community banks are recalibrating their lending strategies to take advantage of some of the exits of the larger lenders, subtle but significant ways. And let me see if I can very quickly just pick up on a couple of the key. The ability to renew or reprice many loans without much of a problem is something that the little guys do a much better job at. There's little issue with making the numbers work, said one consultant. And even when problems do arise, borrowers frequently return to renegotiate or ask for forbearance, something the experts framed as a good sign, suggesting both engagement and a level of stability from that. But while much of the commercial real estate sector focuses on the 10-year treasury note or benchmarks like the federal funds rate or SOFR, that's the secured overnight financing rate, smaller banks are paying close attention to the 5-year point on the yield term. So not quite the near-term focus. The focus is tied to common 3 to 5-year loan cycles. And then there's the ability, more of the smaller banks are offering some interest-only options. So, you know, you do a shorter-term interest-only and then refinance into something that's got full debt service. In any event, it's you know, there's so many industries where the small players are more nimble than the big. And I guess, you know, with the current, you know, some of the private equity lending options have gone away, at least temporarily, and so that creates the void. We're close to the end of the show, it looks like, about a minute left here, so I just want to thank you for tuning in. We will return this coming Sunday right here on KSEV AM 700 and KGBC AM 1540, and I'm not sure if we'll have a cybersecurity show or not this weekend. I think we are. I think we're set up with Mr. AI Wynn's return, and so we'll look forward to discussing some of those topics. Always interesting. Well, thank you again, and we look forward to the next time.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Ooh.